This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Turul Mende, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Tarek El-Aris about his new book, Water on Fire, A Memoir of War. Welcome to the show, Tarek.
Thank you, Turul.
Tarek, you wanted to read an excerpt from the book first, so we start with that maybe first.
Okay, I'm going to read from chapter 11, the beginning of chapter 11, which is I arrived from Lebanon in upstate New York in 1994. And, you know, things happened. So I'll read for a little bit and then we'll talk. The chapter's title is In Erie Canal, and Erie with double E here. I got a new office overlooking the main quad. It was time to cull, unpack my library. What books can continue the journey with me from Beirut to Abidjan, upstate New York to New York City, and from Austin to Hanover, New Hampshire? As I was going over my theory books, I picked up one about ghosts, the end of the Cold War, and the return of the repressed. But as I pulled it off the shelf, a note fell out. The note was a short paragraph describing a condition called delusions of parasitosis, also known as delusional infestation. This rare condition afflicts patients who become convinced that insects have infested their surroundings, crawling on their skin. Doctors report that patients pick at their skin to produce samples. They can pick up scabs or lint or other items that they might consider to be the parasite devouring them. When I found the note, I looked up its origin and discovered that it was a photocopy of a page from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM, 4th edition, in the section on psychotic disorder. The note was an old photocopy with the ink somewhat faded. There is a ghostly shadow captured in the image, blurring the top part of the page, but leaving the paragraph intact. One can surmise that the copy was taken in haste on an old copier in a doctor's office in the late 90s. The copy was taken by the doctor himself in between patients towards the end of the day in an office complex overlooking Cayuga Lake in Ithaca, New York. It must have been dark that day, a winter day, no doubt, turning the spacious yet dimly lit office into something akin to a classroom or one of those rooms used for AA meetings. There was no exam table or scale or blood pressure monitor. The patients came to that room to share, looking for someone to believe them, to acknowledge a pain that kept them from sleeping. The patients spoke of little creatures that came to them under the cover of darkness so that no one could witness their assault. They even brought evidence of the nightly raids, bits of lint, cocoons of agony. The patients came to tell their stories, to plead with the doctor to look further, deeper, to send the samples out to labs with sophisticated microscopes that might finally uncover the perpetrator's identity. They spoke nervously. Their jittery speech carried the vibrations of those monstrous drills with which the creatures were poking at their skin at night. They spoke hastily, with their heartbeat reaching speeds and crescendos that would have made the blood pressure monitor burst and break. They were like the survivors of catastrophic events such as wars and genocides that were never covered by any media and were now forgotten. The patients came to that doctor's office in a solemn procession, offering bits and pieces of their own flesh. They were exhausted, drained, desperate to make a last stand against the forces of darkness. They were anxious to get rid of those spirits that one could find in the Arabian Nights and in the narratives of the possessed, who seek out mediums and witch doctors for exorcism and amulets. But what these patients would eventually realize is that to make the drilling stop or learn how to live with it, they needed to enter those portals that were now opening on their lacerated skin. They needed to pull at the thread of their cocoons, unwrap them, and retrieve a long history of separation and displacement. The suitcase was too big. The lady at the check-in counter refused to let it through. She was adamant. I had to wait while my mom and her friend, who were accompanying me to the airport that day, went to the back cellars in the nearby neighborhood to buy me two medium-sized bags. But I wanted the big one. I wanted all my belongings to travel together. I wanted a suitcase in which I could fit, a suitcase that I wished my brothers and sister had when they left for the US for the first time to reunite with their mother. I wish they had a large suitcase like this one so that I could sneak into it at night without them seeing me, without them wanting to take me. No need for oxygen tanks and special operation commandos to travel in the suitcase. All that one needs is to get into a fetal position and receive nourishments from the tightly packed clothes and books. I was leaving Lebanon for good. I asked the driver to take the long way to the airport along the beachfront or corniche so I could encircle the city one last time, so I could imprint my mind with the view of the Beirut Sea. I wanted to inhale its smell and preserve it within me, that smell which impregnated my entrails on that day in August, would gestate and rise again every summer, tickling my nostrils and connecting me to the place I left behind. I close my eyes and start smelling the algae at low tide, baking in the sun. Green and purple algae wrapped around the rocks like lace and tassel, revealing the holes and crevices where crab and fish seek shelter from the predators of the open sea. The algae and seaweed eggs generate a special kind of pheromones that turned me into a creature of the sea, into a creature of desire, answering their mating call every summer, no matter where I am or whom I'm with. Every summer, I start smelling the Beirut Sea. Every summer, I start feeling the pointy rocks poke at my feet as I head out to dive into the deep. The pain that I feel when walking on the rocks with bare feet and the seaweed smells of the sea are the ingredients of my sensuous being. they reward me for reuniting with them and punish me for replacing them with other smells and bodies of water. A few weeks into my arrival in upstate New York, I was invited by a couple of newly made friends to go on a boat on Lake Ontario. It was a small sailboat, and I was going to learn everything about sailing and skipper duties. We picked up sandwiches and drinks and headed up to the lake. It was a cold and cloudy day, nothing compared to the seascape I had left behind. As the boat was cutting through the waves on the windy lake, I started feeling nauseous. I stuck my head out to the side, and the food and whatever was in those entrails started gushing out. It was like that scene from Brokeback Mountain when Ennis broke down after Jack drove away. I'll stop here, Tugrul.
Thank you so much, Tarek. That was really great. Why did you choose this particular chapter for reading it out?
Because this is really, by the end, you know, this is me arriving in New York, in upstate New York, first Rochester and then Ithaca in 1994. And this is where my body starts remembering. This is the beginning where memory is no longer in your mind, but your body is reacting to your new environment. And this is where also I started becoming interested in the question of the somatic, of affect, of where, you know, I start reacting to the water, I react to the, you know, to the dryness that was inside the homes, because, you know, it's cold in upstate New York, and I come from a you know, I come from a quite humid, you know, climate in Beirut. So my skin is breaking. My relation to water here, there is a lake. I left the sea. Is the lake similar to the sea? Can I replace what I left behind? Can I create a new home? So all these questions somehow play out. I mean, they play out throughout the book. Of what does it mean to be at home, and what does home mean, and what does it mean to remember it and to keep it with you, and how also your body becomes a kind of the stage for this memory in all its beauty and sensuality, but also in all its horror.
Thank you so much, and maybe since it is a memoir, maybe for the listeners who don't know you, maybe can you tell us a bit about yourself first and how you became a professor at Dartmouth?
Yeah, I mean, the memoir is I mean, it starts in an analyst office on the Upper West Side in New York, where, you know, I just finished graduate school at Cornell, and I'm experiencing some graduate school burnout, which is very common, but of course you don't realize what's happening to you, and I understand there is something I needed to work through. But I wasn't sure that what it was exactly. I thought it was more personal issues. And then I go, and then the analyst says, well, you know, I said, why are you here? I said, well, you know, my mom, my dad, my relationships, you know. So, and then she says, well, so I said, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about, you know, where I come from and the family structure. And I tell her, you know, I come from the 19th century. I'm very much like Freud's patients. I come from the 19th century. And she looks at me and she says, well, I thought you were from Lebanon. Don't you want to talk about the war? And here, you know, she sees me as a victim of trauma, and I'm not. And for me, this is still not registering. That there is a, that after living in Lebanon, growing up during the Civil War in the 70s and 80s, that experience has somehow transformed my outlook on the world, because that was the norm for us, and we didn't know anything outside of it, and so to think that there is something wrong with the, because that was the norm, that was how you saw the world, you interpreted things, and so on. So this is where, if you want, that process of kind of, you know, understanding how these experiences and the personal also shapes the intellectual and shapes the academic. Because, you know, coming out of that environment, you really, you begin to understand why, like, I turned to literature, why I turned to philosophy, why I turned to theory, and to things that allowed me to create meaning and fix meaning when the meaning around me was uncertain and unpredictable because of, you know, because of the unpredictability of the war. And so you had to create your own meaning. You have to make your own interpretations. You have to create the theories that allow you to read, you know, your reality, to know if this is safe or unsafe, or, you know, because everything around you has, you know, requires you to develop your own system of interpretation. So I studied philosophy at the American University of Beirut, and I was really kind of interested in these questions about, you know, who we are, where we come from, how do we read, how do we interpret, how do we think in the place of thought. And then I became very, you know, I loved literature, I loved poetry, I used to write poetry as a kid, and I discovered comparative literature through a teacher, and then I went and did the master's in comparative literature at Rochester, and then a PhD at Cornell. And so I was very interested, obviously, in literary theory, which is where philosophy and literature come together, which is where this interpretation model becomes really a profession for me. But it comes also from my experience growing up in the war, where you have to interpret, where you have to read. And the scene I read for you, chapter 11, you know, I end up arguing that my body becomes something I read. You know, I read for clues of these insects that I think they're insects, you know, but it's also in my mind. So I come from, you know, philosophy, comparative literature, and then I end up, you know, writing on the Nahda. I wrote about Arab modernity, but also Arab modernity and the travelers, Arab travelers in the West. And I read that through the somatic perspective, through the body, as a reaction also of the body to the new environment. So, you know, you begin to think about are your work as an academic also as being very personal in many ways. I mean, you realize this after. And then I wrote a lot about the Nahda. I wrote a book, you know, called Trials of Arab Modernity. Then I became interested in the digital age. And then I, you know, my very first job was at NYU. I lived in New York City. I was there on 9/11. And then I moved to Austin, Texas, where I was there for 9 years. Also formative moment in my career. And then 2017, I came to Dartmouth, you know, where now I chair the Middle Eastern Studies Department, but I also teach, you know, comparative literature. I teach a variety of courses dealing with the subject.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Thank you so much. And I think writing a memoir is really a personal act, kind of. And when did you always wanted to write a memoir since the beginning, or when did the idea of Water on Fire emerged?
So the theoretical training I had, there is no I. There is no room for the I. You don't bring the personal in any way. You just describe what's happening in the text. And so for me to bring the I was huge. I mean, you know, betrayal of my training, of where I come from. But it came because I'm also in dialogue with a lot of artists, you know, conceptual artists from the Middle East. Sometimes they invite me. And of course, like in the art world, you know, in the biennials in Berlin and Sharjah, Beirut. I mean, there is a different kind of speak, you know, if it's a different kind of communication, of language, where the personal is fundamental to how things are understood and expressed and so on. So I wrote a couple of talks, one, The Beachcomber, you know, which is about going to the beach every day during the war in Beirut. And then I wrote another, I gave another talk in Beirut at Ashkal Alwan about mfatta, which is this very traditional Beiruti dish that takes hours to make. And, you know, it's, you know, you burn your hands, you have to stir. I mean, it's a family event. And then I researched it and I discovered it was related to the memory of Job, you know, the prophet from the Old Testament, and Beirut was a city dedicated to Job. So I said, and then I said, there is a book here, there is a memoir here that I would write later on. You know, so I understood after writing these two essays that there will be, that I would, and I sketched out, like, you know, a chapter on this, a chapter on that. Of course, I eventually modified them, but I had this idea. And then I said, okay, later on. Usually you write memoirs at a later stage in life. So, but then when COVID happened, when the lockdown of the pandemic happened in 2020, spring 2020, it brought me back to the war and to the anxiety of the war, to the, you know, to the lockdown that we experienced, not being able to go out, not knowing what's happening, not knowing whether we're gonna survive or die, you know, this invisible virus that might just wipe us all. So I wrote, and whether food or water is gonna be available. I mean, a lot of things brought me back to the moment of war. And this is when I wrote Sediments. I wrote the chapter on water, which is chapter 3, and how we used to collect water, store water during the war. And I felt like this is the time to write the book. I felt it brought me back to those experiences, and those stories, those, you know, this writing started to come out of me. And then I applied for a grant. I applied for the Guggenheim. I got it, and I took a year off, you know, and then I finished the book. So it was that experience really that made it urgent for me to kind of re-examine that other encounter with death, you know, that is the war that I, you know, that I experienced as a kid.
And can you tell us a bit about the title? What do you mean by Water on Fire? And the cover, it's quite striking as I looked at it, how the people are like jumping into the water when there is like smoke rising in the horizon. So can you tell us about how that came together?
You know, I kept thinking of a song by Abd al-Halim, you know, Abd al-Halim Hafiz, the Egyptian singer. He sings a song for Nizar Kabbani, the Syrian poet Nizar Kabbani, who's actually mentioned in the book because my mom is a Kabbani and related. But it's, he says, in Qari'atul Finjan, you know, the fortune teller. And in Arabic it says, Maqduruka an tabqa daiman maqduruka an tabqa bayna al-ma'i wa bayna al-nar, is that your destiny is to remain forever stuck between fire and water, by between water and fire. And really the book started with this chapter, The Beachcomber, where we go to the beach every day because Beirut is encircled, where, you know, there's, you can't leave, you're being bombed, and the only outlet is the beach. So the water, the beachfront, is the space that is between the fire of war and the water that you dive into, that a world that you can also exist in while withstanding the violence of war. And then this notion of water, and I took, you know, the chapter I read, I talk about how, you know, when I came to the US, I was taking these showers, these hot showers every day until my skin broke. So the water is something that comforts you, that cleanses you, but also something that burns you. So this notion of of water, I mean, Beirut, of course, but also, you know, water as something we really missed and lacked and stored and collected dearly, you know, during sieges, during, you know, closures and sieges that we experienced in Beirut and, you know, in the 80s, especially. This is became kind of a theme. And then I say at the end, like, I'm a creature of water because I, you know, I grew up by the beach just as kind of the only outlet we had, you know, no mountain, no other outlet. We were kind of stuck in this enclave where we only had the sea. And so this notion of water and fire, or between water and fire, has been like very important from the beginning as a space that you can occupy within this, you know, within this conflict, with and of course the publisher actually chose the they did the cover, but I love the cover because, you know, that's exactly, I felt like they beautifully captured what the book is about. I mean, that's me and my friends at the beach in Beirut while the war is going on, and there is, you know, chapter 2 talks about an episode at the beach while the war is going on, and, you know, something happens. I don't want to spoil everything for the potential readers.
No, thank you so much. And you are alternating between your childhood and when you are adult in the book. What made you choose this path of writing this way, this kind of memoir in this way?
We come back to this urge to interpret. Mm. And interpretation, and the adult and the theorist wants to interpret immediately, and I had to hold off on this interpretation. I had to let the child come to the fore and let the child remember and let the child speak. And so that was one of the hardest thing for me, especially, who's coming from an academic theoretical background, and I want to recreate a scene where do we as close as possible to how the child that I was experienced and remembers it, you know. And so this is the kind of back and forth. So I have to allow myself to go to that moment, and what do you capture? And this is where, you know, I mean, I'm obviously engaged with psychoanalysis and but also critical of it throughout my work, but this is where, you know, you have to allow the association to come. You have to allow, you want to make sure, you know, you want to try to give room to that association, that memory, that to come and to capture the emotion associated with it. And then you want to make sense of it or situate it as part of a larger narrative. So it was a challenge to write this book because, again, like the academic, the theorist wants to make sure that, you know, you start point A, you go back, you end at point, I don't know, E, and then you have a clear arch that connects and you bring it all together and there is a clear argument. And this is not, you know, here you have to allow the associations to come. You have to allow some level of meandering, you know, of erring and of going to places you were not planning to go or you didn't expect to go, and taking that dive, you know, that you see on the cover, and see where you come out at the other end. And so this idea of withholding interpretation, of letting the child speak, of taking that risk, this is really what I try to work on a lot, and to catch myself whenever I felt like I want to go to the interpretation and say what this means, because I'm also a reader of text. So I'm trying, like, not to read my text, but, you know, as I'm writing it. And this was the big challenge.
And your work was quite different before you wrote this memoir, as you already told us. And how is maybe still the memoir connected to your overall research, and how different was it for you to write the memoir instead, like a scholarly book?
Yeah, this is, I mean, what I just described about that kind of withholding interpretation and so on, and what I'm, you know, my work, this is where I'm bringing also the eye, the body into my own work. And this is something I've been thinking about, also like thinking about auto theory of certain genres where the engagement with theory is no longer like I argue and this is the footnote and this is like, how do we also think in a new language or write in new genres? And still doing the kind of theoretical philosophical work that I've been interested in, and also engage with the literary, because you know there are a lot of literary references in the book to the literature I've worked on that also shaped me as a reader, as a scholar that I were, you know, that I've written about and so on. So I felt like this is also kind of, it's a memoir, it's to remember, but it's also an engagement with theory. It's also a way of thinking how the eye comes in and allow us to write differently as theorists as well, and explore other levels of insight into texts, into historical periods, into, concepts that like the concept of trauma, for instance, which is really very much like I put it in the book, and I try to see where, you know, how it fits and how it manifests itself, and is that, does that correspond to the kind of trauma theory I've studied as well, because I also have that in the back of my mind. So the experience, the personal, is also in dialogue with the theoretical, and sometimes challenging it, sometimes also taking it into another level, or trying to come up with something that is true to what I feel and what I experienced, and where the theoretical might not, or the theory that I was trained in might not fully account for. And so there is, and that's been kind of part of my work, where, you know, I take psychoanalysis, but I push against it and say, these are the limits. Beyond that, we need to think about questions of leaks, or we need to think about the somatic or breakdown and so on, or the affective as a register. So the book is doing something similar, but through a personal narrative, where also the personal and the I is implicated in that process, whereas I'm not just simply reflecting from afar, in a kind of a disembodied way, but I'm fully embodied, I'm fully present in this text.
And did you had any inspirations while working on the text, or did you had any authors in mind who wrote memoirs as well that you looked up maybe and saw how they wrote their texts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in dialogue. I have these authors who live with me. They are like... You know, they're my ghosts, my jinn, and they live with me. I mean, obviously, one of the authors that I'm in dialogue with and I work on a lot is Huda Barakat, and something like Rasa'il Ghariba, or The Stranger's Letter, but also all her literature, all her novels really are very much part of, you know, my engagement with Arabic literature. And there is also Jacques Derrida, for instance, the passage I was reading. I mean, I then connected to the monolinguism of the other, this experience of displacement, leaving Algeria, going to France. So this engagement with French theory. Here with the question also of memory and the smells. I mean, I go to Proust. Marcel Proust in the French context. So you have all these authors that inhabit you and that also speak through you. I mean, there is Goethe. You'll see there is a chapter where, you know, Mephisto comes to me at night, and then, you know, I have this conversation. So you have, I mean, this is also the comparative literary training, which is, you know, Arabic and French and contemporary, but also there is Shamfara, you know, the pre-Islamic poet, the Sa'luk, that I've also written about, that I'm very interested in, who starts his Lamia, you know, raise, أقيموا بني أمي صدور مطيكم, you know, like raise children of my mother, the your mounts, for I tend to another tribe, you know. إني لقوم سواكم لأميل, you know. So this idea of departure, this idea of leaving the tribe, this idea of leaving home, and what does that do to you? So from the pre-Islamic to the contemporary experiences of displacement, of dislocation, of thinking about also memory, of thinking about how we become constituted as subjects when we also go through these experiences, when we leave home, when we go through, you know, live through wars and try to recognize its symptoms, and how do we live with it? How do we recognize its symptoms? I mean, what I was reading to you, chapter 11, is all about how to recognize the symptoms of war. How does war come with you in the bag, you know, the suitcase, and how it comes to you at night in other forms that you think are coming from elsewhere, but actually these are things you also brought along. So these are the kind of references that you will see in the book. There's, you know, there are others, but these are some of the most important ones.
And was it hard for you to find maybe the right publisher for this kind of work, or were you approached by the publisher to publish such a text? How was the relationship with the publisher during this process?
This is Other Press, and Judith Gurevich, who's the publisher, who also is a psychoanalyst, has a background in psychoanalysis, and is in dialogue with you know, a lot of also authors, academics that I'm in dialogue with. And I knew and we met, you know, we met through friends, just and then I was working on the book. But I was also, I knew I wanted to see if this could cross to, you know, like to expand the audience, because I feel like I've been, you know, the academic context is important, is necessary, and I think they will greatly benefit from this, because this is really an engagement with theory. But I also wanted to bring other people into the conversation that me and my colleagues have been having for a while now. So can we expand that conversation between, you know, Middle Eastern studies, theory, psychoanalysis, affect theory, and bring other people into the conversation? And this is how, you know, this book came about, at least with this particular publisher, is that would this appeal or be readable by non-academics as well? And that's also a big question. Again, like that a lot of my colleagues at this stage in their career, when they've, okay, they got the promotions and so on, they've done what they needed to do for certain, you know, within certain academic rules, and where you have to publish with, you know, peer-reviewed monographs and so on. Do you continue to do that? Do you expand? And this is how, you know, meeting this person, meeting this publisher, and then eventually she said, "What are you writing?" And I sent her the manuscript. She said, "Okay, you know, I think this would, you know, I think this would expand the conversation the way you're thinking about it." And so it's kind of an experiment for me. It's the first time I publish a trade book, obviously, but I'm hoping that, you know, I'm expanding the audience, the readership, you know, from, in addition to the academic, I'm also bringing in other people who might be interested in knowing also what we're thinking and what we're struggling with and what we're trying to resolve, in you know, as academics, as people working in comparative literature, and in the fields at the intersection of which I work.
Thank you so much, Tarek. And coming to the end of our podcast, maybe can you tell us a bit about what you are working on next, maybe, or if you can reveal your next project?
There are my kind of academic projects that I've been working on, which is this notion of the other in Arabic literature, starting from Shamfara. You know, I've worked on this notion of the savage, of the beastly, of tawahush. So that's an ongoing project that I'm going to work on turning it into a book. I might turn it into a book maybe in this new genre. You know, I don't know if I want to come back to writing exactly the way I was. So there is definitely the beast, the other project that definitely, and part of it is this question of time, of monstrosity, and obviously, you know, these are also very pertinent and important topics today that I would like to continue to revisit or continue to work on and develop into a book. Whether I publish it the same way I'm publishing this one, or do I, you know, go back to publishing it, I don't know, with Princeton or Fordham, or, you know, these are questions. I'm gonna see where this the reception to this is gonna, how, what is it going to do, and I'm curious to see in what direction I will continue after this,
thank you so much, Tarek, for your time. It was great to have you here, and I learned a lot about your work. Again, thank you so much, Tarek.
Thank you, Tughlu. Thank you very much.